essay two, the second essay of the Kusari, the Judah Levi, and we are in chapter or paragraph 29. Did I say 29?
Yeah, that's
29. The last part we learned was 24. 23, 24, all talked about the significance of Eretz Yisrael. And that, therefore, brought us to a discussion of Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi's position with regard to the mitzvah of living in Eretz Yisrael, and we expanded on that for about three or four classes, and I'm certainly not going to go back over that. I mean, for me, it turns out that that was really preparation for my trip. We're going to have to notify people that there is a mitzvah to live in this country. There's a mitzvah to live in this country, and the last time I looked through Torah, I didn't find any place that it said it's a mitzvah to live in New York or Toronto or Mountain or Teaneck for that matter. But it's a mitzvah to live in this country. So we discussed the mitzvah of Yishuv Haaretz. We discussed some of the opinions that are still unfortunately quoted today that might leave the impression as though there is no mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael, and even those expressions of opinion that might even indicate that we may not have a right to be here in Eretz Yisrael. We took care of all of that quite well. Between 24 and 29, there was a masterful essay by Rav Yehuda HaLevi in which he describes the meaning and the inner significance of sacrifice. That in and of itself is a unit that should be dealt with at some time, I don't know when. It's a beautiful, powerful, powerful essay. Toward the end of that essay, he basically tells the king that the heart and the head of the Jewish people, Jewish intellect and Jewish heart, which were represented by the prophets were the intellect of the Jewish people, the Kohanim who performed the service in the Beit HaMikdash, they were the heart. And his essay describes it very, very beautiful, fascinating symbolism. So now the king says to him, in Cain 29, in our English, it's so you are today a body without either head or heart. After this magnificent essay in which he describes prophets and priests as being the head and the heart of all of Jewish existence, with neither priests nor prophets today, so the king says, you're a body with no head or no heart. The Ichabod Crane, I don't know, the headless rider. So the rabbi tells him, what you're saying is absolutely true. But I'm going to go one step further. Not only don't we have a head or a heart, we hardly have a body. And you know what we're like? We're like the dry bones that Ezekiel talked about. If you listen to the Haftorah for Shabbos, Chol HaMoed, Pesach, we read the chapter in Yechezkel where he describes a valley, and the valley is full of dry bones, fossils. And God asks Yechezkel, HaTichgenoha, Tzomos Ha'ela, will these bones come to life? And he says, God, you tell me. And then, of course, he sees the great vision of where all the bones start moving in the direction of making themselves into bodies, and they rise again from the from death. I mean, of course, the symbolism for our generation is certainly absolutely powerful, because we were not only dry bones, we were ash.
Yes,
we were ash that became bones, that became bodies, and then ultimately became an Am Yisrael, a state of Israel, that was reborn again over there. Were unbelievable miracles. So he says, oh, thou sayest rightly.
there's 21 with him.
The rabbi replied, what you say is true. Moreover, we have no real body, just scattered bones, similar to the dry bones that Ezekiel saw in his vision. But he's going to say, there are bones and there are bones. There are different kinds of bones. These bones, however, O king of the Tarsars, which have retained a trace of vital power, there's still something of the divine in those bones. And as long as there's something of the divine in there, who was it? But ladies, we used to sing as kids, one of those
Their bones
shall rise again.
Their bones.
Their bones?
Them bones.
Oh Lord, he said he'd make a man.
Them bones shall rise again.
If anybody hears the tape of this class. I'm sure that it was called a Negro spirit. Negro spiritual. Today they call it the black rock. You understand? And yes, Yechezkel says they were dry bones, and we're bones. But boy, these bones have awesome potential, which have retained a trace of vital power, having once been the seat of our heart, brain, breath, soul, and intellect, are better than certain bodies formed of marble and plaster. Endowed with heads, eyes, ears, and all limbs, in which never dwelt the spirit of life, nor ever can dwell in them, since they are but imitations of man, not men in reality. What he's going to be talking about is the difference between the Jewish people and other nations on the face of this earth. At least our bones were ones that had real life and real vitality and divinity in them. Far, far different than all sorts of other images, dead images on the face of this earth.
Oh, come on.
I'm telling you, in that valley of the bones, it was very quiet. The only time there was noise, and Yechezkel talks about it, he says, as the bones started moving toward each other, there was a tremendous amount of noise in the valley. You understand? Bones banging against bones. And then a bone then picked up a cell phone. So the king says, you're right. It is as thou sayest, you're right. That there's a big difference between those bones and really the pagan and heathen nations and all of their all of the images that they create. Number 32. The dead nations which desire to be held equal to the living people can obtain nothing more than an external resemblance. He says there are many people on the face of this earth that try to mimic us. They try to present a picture to the world of a people full of vitality and full of strength. And the fact is that they did build tremendous edifices, great cultures. And he's going to describe what happened to all of those great cultures. They built houses for God, but no trace of him was visible therein. They all built great temples, but God never presented himself there. There was never any evidence, of divine fire coming down from heaven, the word of God coming from there. When there were oracles, it was usually some kind of a trick that was used in order to convince the populace that there's something there, but there was nothing ever there. They turned hermits and ascetics in order to secure inspiration, but it came not. They became people who sort of separated themselves from the world. They lived in isolation in the hope that some kind of a divine spirit will come down to them and they become prophets. And there wasn't a single one throughout all of the history. They then deteriorated, became disobedient and wicked. And you know what's fascinating? Though they became wicked. And that was usually because all idolatry was involved in promiscuity and evil. And you know what? They did terrible things. And no punishment came down from heaven. Not that Abihu was struck down in the Beit HaMikdash, in the Mishkan. You know what it means? Their being struck down is an indication of a living people with a living God. A God who cares about them, who's involved with them, who knows them. Yes?
What about the prophecy of Bilam?
What about the prophecy?
They had this great prophecy on the level of Moshe, but it was for evil, true.
Wow. But do you know why Bilam saw that prophecy? That Bilam saw that prophecy only because of the Jewish people. God told the nations of the world, you have complaints to me that there is no Moses by you. I'll give you your own fashlugan of Moses, and let's see what's going to happen to him. Bilam did not achieve prophecy by virtue of his own greatness and his striving for sanctity and holiness. It was something that was foisted upon him by God for one moment in history. Can you imagine a guy saying and meaning, Matovu o Alecho Yaakov, Mishkan Osech Yisrael? Bilam most probably was choking on every word as it came out of his mouth. Bilam was not a prophet. Bilam was a killer. Bilam was a unrepentant anti-Semite. Fagus Gemara. The Gemara says there were three members in the cabinet of Paro, the 1C conference of Paro. What are we going to do with the Jews? And Bilam is the one who said, gas chambers, kill them. Eov remained silent. Yitro objected and fled. And the Gemara says because of that, Yitro, who objected and fled, stood up, had courage. Understand? Yitro had courage. Oy, do we need people with courage. All the people who we thought had courage are falling like dominoes one after another. Courage! So he became the father-in-law of Moshe Rabbeinu. Eov, who remained silent, was caused to suffer. There's the famous work of the Brisker Rav. Famous work of the Brisker Rav. I used to use it every so often. I'd be standing on street corners or on the Jerusalem Tel Aviv highway by Kiryat Moshe, standing with a sign demonstrating against something. And there'd be some Ben Torah Yeshiva man who walks by and says, well, what are you doing over here? It's not going to help. It's not, you know, they make fun of me. And I love that because I felt like the suffering servant of God. And here I am. I'm doing this great and serious nefesh. And I told a number of them, the Brisker Rav, like Yitzchak Zay Soloveitchik once said the following. Eov remained silent. So he was punished from suffering. Wow. Eov made a calculation. You know what his calculation was? He was a Gosha politician here. Paro was for it. You understand? Paro was for it. Bilam is for it. Yitro is gone. It's two against one. So the chances that I'm going to win, I mean, I'm outnumbered 2-1. So what's the point? So he remains silent. So the Brisker Rav said, so why is he punished with suffering? Even if you remain silent, but if it really hurt you, the plan against the Jewish people would hurt you, there should have been a krechts. You should have oy vey. Eov's silence did not include even an oy vey. So the Rebbeinu told him, oh yeah, you're going to learn the meaning of oy vey. You're going to learn what suffering is. So I told these fellows, it may not help at all, but because it doesn't help, it doesn't hurt, I have to demonstrate that it hurts. I wiped out two guys with Daniels there. I wiped them out. They're still laying around over there on the floor. They don't know I did that. If it hurts, it hurts. And you have to be able to speak out. And you don't always have to be the one who figures out carefully, will it help, won't it help? Will I succeed or will I not succeed? Will I lose my position or won't I lose my position? Will I be liked or will I not be liked? You have to be able to get up and have courage to say what you believe to be true.
Yesterday you talked about silence.
What did I?
Yesterday you shared.
Yes. Not this kind of silence.
No, but there are two different kinds of silence.
Of course there are different kinds of silence. A tragedy befalls you, so what should you do? This is what you did to me? Then you remain silent? Of course there are different kinds. In my elementary school yearbook, I graduated grade 8. So the yearbook under my picture, they wrote, "Silence is golden." Could you ever imagine me as a silent guy? I always tell my wife, she doesn't believe me, I was a very quiet, cute, angel little boy. I made no trouble. I was very well behaved. And nobody believed it. Nobody believed it. But I'm telling you, it's in my yearbook.
What happened? You saved it all for us. There's a time and place for
us. There's a time and place. There's a time for silence. Exactly. Eight Lishtok. And eight, what's the other eight? Eight Lindaber? I don't know. There's a time to be silent. There's a time to speak out. But at least Eov should have felt the pain of what he is witnessing. Not even that. Wait a minute. Wait, yes?
Is the silence you're talking about today apathy?
That really has nothing to do with the Kuzri. And you are part of the sinister plot to get me off. I'm kidding. But I say, you know what? I'll tell you what I want to say. It's exhaustion. That's the best that I can say about it. It's exhaustion. We have been through a great deal. Now you can keep up the sense of crying out, you can keep it up a year, 2 years, 3 years. We're all exhausted. And you're not part of any sinister plot. Yes?
I was thinking you were Vayidom Aharon.
Yes, we talked about that yesterday. Yes, the silence of, but the silence of Eov, there's a big, that's it. Take the two of those. Take Aaron's silence and take Eov's silence. Eov is silent when the plan for the final solution of the Jewish people is being approved. That's one silence. And Aaron was silent before the judgment of God. Two completely different silences. But we also added a third one. The third one that we've added is the silence of exhaustion. And there's another word I want to use. It's a sense of helplessness. There are times you feel that you just don't make a difference anymore.
Not you.
No, I've begun to feel lately that we don't make a difference. You can go to the polls and you can vote for somebody who you assume is going to do X, Y, and Z, and it doesn't happen. Precisely the opposite. In a sense, I feel disenfranchised. Yep. I feel powerless. Okay. They then deteriorated, became disobedient and wicked, yet no fire fell down from heaven upon them, nor rapid pestilence. What he's referring to is what happened, yes, with Nodavavim. What happened after the sin that Jews asked for, basar, they asked for meat, and God gave them their meat, and then there were many who died in a pestilence afterwards. as a manifest punishment from God for their disobedience. You know, it may not be a good example, but even when a parent gets upset with a child, child deep down knows that that's an indication that you care. When you do nothing, you know what? You don't count. So it says here, all these nations with all of their idols, and it was never any manifestation of anything. Nobody really cared. Their heart, I mean the house in which they used to meet, was destroyed, but otherwise their status was not affected. He said, even when their temples were destroyed, and there must have been thousands of temples that ultimately were destroyed, did it affect them as a people? No. We are still mourning the Churban Beis HaMikdash 2,000 years later. And we're still saying, Mehega Yibane HaMikdash, that's the famous Napoleon. When Napoleon, in fact, no, if I'm going to tell you Napoleon already, then I'm going to tell you two stories about Napoleon. I was once introduced in a synagogue in the United States in a certain community, and the rabbi introduced me that we have a guest today, Rabbi Kohl, from Yerushalayim of Eretz Yisrael, and he's visiting this community, which is the Yerushalayim of America.
Oh.
Now, that I remained silent then was, of course, one of the great moments of my career. I was ready to dig a hole and disappear someplace. Because I hold that you don't have a right to call any place on the face of this earth Yerushalayim. I was just talking, my wife showed me something. There is more than a legend, it's a Kabbalah by Klausler, that when Ezra came back to Eretz Yisrael at the return from Galus Babel, he sent letters to Jewish communities all over the world, inviting them to join him in the great adventure of rebuilding Eretz Yisrael. In most communities of the world, they threw his letter into the garbage can. We know of one response, and that response came from the Jews of the Rhineland. During the first exile, there were Jews already in Gaul, in France, along the Rhine, Alsace-Lorraine. And the response came from those communities there saying, Atem shvu b'Yerushalayim ha-Gedolah v'anachnu neshem b'Yerushalayim ha-Ketana. You can live in the big Yerushalayim, and we're going to live in the little Yerushalayim. And there is a Kabbalah by Klal Yisrael that those communities were destroyed 1,500 years later during the Crusades because of that response to Ezra and Tanya. So therefore, I say you're not allowed to call any place on the earth Yerushalayim. I think in Queens it was once a big pizza parlor, Jerusalem too, yeah. And it burned down. That was Pashut Churban Bayis Shlishi, you understand. Jerusalem West, you understand, that burned down. All right. You're not allowed to call any place in Yerushalayim. I have proof from the Gemara, I have proof from a lot of places you can't call any place in Yerushalayim. So somebody asked, I once said this year, some years ago, so somebody asked, but Rabbi, Vilna was called the Yerushalayim Delita. There are even books that describe Vilna as Yerushalayim Delita. I remember there was a time, for some strange reason, they called Baltimore Yerushalayim d'America. Echveis at the turn of some century or other. We've been through a few centuries already. And I said, it can't be. It can't be. I know that Vilna was called Yerushalayim d'America. I said, I can't believe that it came from a Jewish source. A few years after I said this year, a Yid by the name of Hyman Flax, Olav HaShalom, came into shul one day and says, Rabbi, that's Yerushalayim, died a few years ago, wonderful, wonderful person. Rabbi, you are right. And he shows me an article in which it says that when Napoleon conquered Vilna, they took him through the Vilna ghetto, and Napoleon said, "My, this looks just like Jerusalem." The one who coined the phrase that Vilna is the Yerushalayim of the litter was Napoleon. It wasn't the Vilna Goin. Trust me, it wasn't the Vilna Goin. The Vilna Goin is the one who prayed that God should give him the schus, that he should be able to go to Eretz Yisrael and plant a fruit-bearing tree b'sivat Yerushalayim, somewhere around Yerushalayim. But that's not what I was talking about. What I really wanted to get to is, they also say about Jerusalem, about Vilna, that when Napoleon was there, they brought him into a shul and he saw Jews who were sitting on the floor and they were crying. So they explained to him, it's the Tisha B'Av, it's the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. He wondered about how long ago was this house destroyed. Thought about 1700 years ago. He said that people who can cry like that 1700 years after the destruction of their house, that people will never die and they can get that building back again. That's the pshat. I don't know what that had. Oh, I know what it had to do. They had so many temples and their temples were destroyed, but it didn't affect them in any way. It didn't make any difference. This could only take place in accordance with the largeness or smallness of their number. You know, he's saying something that we really had elaborated on in a shiur some while ago, and it becomes even more important to me now. You'll see. He says, the existence, the survival, the strength of nations of the world depended in accordance with their largeness or the smallness of their number, with their strength or weakness, with their union or unity, following upon natural or accidental causes. When I said a shiur a few weeks ago about the essential difference between Jewish history and the history of the world, so I differentiated between them by saying that Jewish history is qualitatively different than the history of all nations of the world. The history of all nations of the world move in chronological order by cause and effect. A leads to B, leads to C. 1, 2, 3. Straight line. And therefore, in terms of cause and effect, there can always be the cause that will bring the effect of destruction. Jewish history is completely different. Jewish history does not work by cause and effect. Jewish history works on the basis of a predetermined goal and an objective. As I pointed out then, the Jews arrive at Sinai to receive Torah because they went out of Egypt? Or did they go out of Egypt in order to get to Sinai? Obviously, it's the second, it's not the first, it's not that God took Jews out of Egypt. And then, 3 million people here, what are we going to do? We show them the Red Sea already, take them on jeeps for a few days through the desert, and what am I going to do with them afterwards? Oh, I got a good idea. We're going to take them to Sinai, and we're going to get them home. But that was not. The plan was all worked out in advance. They're going out of Egypt in order to arrive at Sinai. Because Jewish history is always determined in advance. In other words, we know the end of Jewish history. It's right there in the Tanakh. All the Eretz Yisrael will be ours. All the nations of the world are going to come to Yerushalayim. For Ha Yashem Lamelech Al Kol Eretz, God is going to be king over the whole earth. We know that that's going to be the end. The Naruel of Kol HaGoyim, all of the nations are going to come flowing to Yerushalayim. Ki Yitzion Teitzei Torah, Udvar Hashem Yerushalayim. All the great prophecies of Isaiah and Micha and Amos, all of that is going to be fulfilled. Because Jewish history, in that sense, is predetermined. It's a history of an eternal people. But he describes how the nations of the world, everything was dependent on natural conditions. Did they have a lot of people? with a few. Did they have material and weapons? Or then was there unity? Now, all of these natural causes affected the existence of nations. I'll tell you, Ken, I was writing upstairs. I'm in the middle of creating it's most probably not a fictional conversation. But don't tell anybody, because I'm going to use it someplace. I don't know where I'm going to use it yet. The scene is a coffee house, an outdoor coffee house in Tel Aviv in early May of 1948. Yitzchak and Yigal and Yosef and Chaim and David are sitting there. Yitzchak says, listen, it's sheer madness. From a political point of view, if the United States is opposed to our announcing the establishment of a state, it's going to bring absolute disaster down upon us. Yosef says, do you know what a war they're preparing war against us if we establish a state? Do you know what that's going to do to us? Economically? How long can the little Yishuv maintain itself economically? They'll capture the Galil and part of the Negev, and there won't be any produce, nothing going on. We're simply going to collapse under the weight of economic difficulties. Somebody else, Ran, God, says, do you know that we don't have ammunition that will last us more than a week? Militarily, we're up against people, nations that have so much weaponry. And each one of them presents the case. We don't have a chance to survive. And then David says, we're going to establish the state of Israel. There was somebody else there who said, demographically, I was sitting at a wedding this week, and I was attacked from both sides. It was an attack. The only thing, on one side, my wife is sitting, so that was not an attack. She was a buffer between the guy who was attacking me on one side, and then there was somebody attacking me on the other side. The one on my right side was somebody who had been in the forefront of the struggle for Eretz Yisrael, and she says to me, the demographic, we can't close our eyes to the demographics. We're going to be overrun. I'm thinking to myself, Ben-Gurion, there are 500,000 Jews in Eretz Yisrael, 100 millionaires. The demographic problem is impossible. We'll never survive demographically. Right? We've been suffering demographically. You know how long we've been suffering demographically? Since Sefer Devarim, when the Rebbeinu said, Lo me'rubchem mikol ha'amim choshak ha'ashem b'chem. God did not desire you because you're the largest nation of the world. Ki atem haba'at mikol ha'amim. Torah says, you're the smallest. Unfortunately, the fact that we've remained the smallest for 3,500 years, that's a big question. Demographically, we never had a leg to stand on. Demographically, we should have simply folded up our tents and disappeared. And here I hear this woman telling me demographics, and I'm looking at her. Thank God you weren't sitting in that coffee house, my fictional coffee house in Tel Aviv. We're never going to win demographically. We're never going to win demographically. There's not a chance. It's impossible. Torah said it clearly. On Ten Hamar, we call on and finish. That's all we talk about. We're never going to win, I don't know, economically. But you know what? We're an amazing people. I don't say it outside this room. I long for David Ben-Gurion. We don't have fromme Juden today who have the courage to take the leap of faith that that man took. It's unbelievable. He's the last prime minister of this country that presented the United Nations with a Tanakh and said, the land belongs to us and it's written here. Yes.
That sense of manifest destiny, that sense of vision.
The sense of vision. There's no vision today.
A book.
And the fellow was sitting on the other side, and said, I love this. The guy was sitting on the other side, and it tells me, we can't buck the United States of America. We need spare parts for our planes, you understand? This accountant over here is telling, he's the größte Kopfmeier who knows that we need spare parts. And then you know who became my hero this morning? I have a new hero. I don't have any heroes left over here. That's it. Finished. Abdullah, King of Jordan.
Yes.
He's, you know what? He embarrasses the president of the United States and causes Bush to Bush. And the world didn't come to an end. And he backed Saddam Hussein first time around, second time around. And the one friend, America needs us more than we need America. Now, if you think that what I'm talking about now is not kuzri, you're making a mistake. Because was that good? I got a fact. Because the kuzri is saying all other nations depend on their size, their strength, unity or disunity. Let me just finish the paragraph, I'll get to you. We, however, since our heart, I mean the Holy House, was destroyed, we, in a sense, were lost with it. If it be restored, we too will be restored. Be we few or many, or in whichever way this may happen. For our Master is the living God, our King, who keeps us in this, our present condition, in dispersion and exile. But he's with us. Yes.
I just saw a statistic. 100 years ago, less than 1% of all the Jews in the world lived here. 50 years ago, it was like 5%. Today, it's 40%. And if just Derech HaTeva keeps some warning, it will be a very short time before the majority of Jews will live here.
I recall an article that appeared in the Jerusalem Post in 1990. The article said the following, that by the end of the decade, or maybe a few years later, man, woman, or child is going to walk off a plane onto the tarmac at Ben Gurion Airport. And at that moment, a dramatic change is going to take place in all of Jewish history. Because that man, woman, or child who's going to step off that plane into Ben Gurion Airport is going to tip the scales, and Eretz Yisrael is going to become the largest Jewish community in the world. I wrote the article, so I remember it. Right? And by the way, that's one of the things good you reminded me. I'm going to tell Jews in Chutz Laaretz. The fact is, I personally believe that Eretz Yisrael today is the largest Jewish community in the world. But you're talking about something else. There's going to be a second stage. The second stage is when the majority of Jews in the world are going to live in Eretz Yisrael. Can you imagine, 50 years ago, there must have been 20, 30 communities, countries in the world that had Jewish communities larger than Eretz Yisrael. Who would have believed it? Who would have believed it? There's no question about it that today we are larger than the United States of America. America already is not, they're not even claiming that for sure there are 5 million Jews there. Here there are, we'll know the exact number, the beginning of next week. They always announce it the day before Yom HaTzmaut, how many Jews there are living over here. And then I know the Jewish from Messiah says, half are Magoyim, the other half are Chilainim, and the others are Chabatskis, you know, you take them all together, they have a lot of it, yeah. All that nonsense, I know that's stupid. But the fact is that we're larger. We are larger than the United States of America, and unfortunately, It's not for, it's for good reason, and it's for very bad reason. The good reason is, yes, the Jews have returned here from all over the world. And the bad reason, of course, is that America continues to lose 100,000 a year, 200,000 a year through assimilation and the marriage. It's a tragic, terrible, tragic situation. So if America may have 4 million Jews today, there are certainly over 500 Jews in Israel. It's the largest Jewish community in the world. But this morning I got up, and, you know, like all sorts of things go through my head, and I didn't plan on foisting all of this on you, but the Rebbe Halevi just did it to me. We have, I'd say, a great deal of information about the period of the second Beit HaMikdash, the second Commonwealth. Those who came with Ezra and Nehemiah. Now, my wife has been taking a course in archaeology and archaeology of Eretz Yisrael. She's been climbing over hills and dales. By the way, you get a lot of practice just living in Harnoa, so she can climb the highest mountain you want any place. And then it struck me, during the whole period of Bayit Sheni, the Second Commonwealth, that was about 500-600 years. Do we have any information about the largest Jewish community in the world, Bava? What happened there? There must have been many yeshivas. There must have been great institutions. There must have been great rabbis. I tell you, I can't mention one name. Do you know when we do have information about Bavel? After the destruction of Bayit Sheni, second Beit HaMikdash, and the codification, the redaction of the Mishnah, then we can start telling you about the communities of Bavel. Suda, Pompadisa, Nehudah, Mosamatsia, Arbaye, Rava, Raftopa, Rabbi Avu. I mean, the many rabbis and tell you about institutions. I can't think of one Babylonian institution during the period of 600 years. And you know what conclusion I'm arriving at? When there is a thriving Jewish community in Eretz Israel, even if it's not as big as others, Jewish history is written here. And all the rest ultimately will be a footnote to Jewish history. I'm sure they're going to love me in America when I tell them you're going to be a footnote. You think they won't even be a footnote?
No, I'm not saying that at all. What I want to tell you is you can encourage all the people that you're going to get to come on Aliyah, that among that group that you're going to get, someone is going to have his picture taken coming
off the plane. I can even arrange it for them if they want it. No, but this is just something I haven't really investigated it. Before I left the house this morning, put a whole bunch of history books on my desk. I want to investigate it. What happened to all of those Jewish communities? And we know, not only Bavel was the largest one, but there were Jewish communities all over the world. What did they do? What did they accomplish? What's left? Nothing. Nothing. I don't know of anything.
I would tell them they should come and be a part of the history.
That's exactly
not,
the
not
point.
To say that you
no, I want to tell them that they can all contribute and they can be part of Jewish history over here. And I'm also going to quote the great thing that adorned our fridge for about 3-4 years. My wife took off the internet a statement by Teddy Roosevelt. Zohar also Ha'ish Latov. Teddy Roosevelt said, "What? Well, first of all, he said, well, you know, did he say follow me, you know?
Yeah.
What was the attack in, where was the attack? In Havana? Where?
Yeah. Cuba.
Hey,
Cuba.
Remember the name.
San Juan
what?
Hill.
What? Remember the name.
Remember the name?
No.
He was to charge up the...
San Juan Hill.
Oh, it's your history. Your history. San Juan Hill. So Teddy Roosevelt said the following. He who does not participate in the passion of his time will be judged as not having lived.
Wow.
I'll say it again. He who does not participate in the passion of his time will be judged as not having lived. The passion of our time for Jews is Eretz Yisrael.
That's a good one to bring.
That's a good one?
You're saying it to the wrong people?
Yeah.
Who am I saying it to? I'm saying it to the right people.
To the converted.
Don't poo-poo my mission before I even get on the plane. Huh?
He's giving us ammunition and medicine to distribute to other people.
That's right. Like, that's the way he's supposed to look at it. Yes.
Yet the bureaucracy of Israel discourages Aliyah. I have just a quickie. It's not much Shahara. It's a friend of mine wanted me as a physiotherapist for the honored profession, needed here, and he tried and giving him all kinds of obstacles in the way.
You're right. That's great. And that's very good reason for somebody not to come on Aliyah. After 120 years, the Rebbein Shom is going to pound on the table and say, why didn't you come live in my country? Do you think the guy is going to say, God Almighty, you know that Israeli bureaucracy? You know what? The guy is going to become so small, he's going to want to hide someplace. And then there's a second thing I'll tell you. My children were all born in Canada, and then we moved to the United States of America. Did you ever have to deal with American Immigration Authority?
Yes.
Never in your life.
Yes.
And I tell you, give me a dumb Pakid in Ukraine over a Pakid in Brooklyn, downtown Brooklyn. You're kidding me? I was ready to run out of there and scream bloody murder. How do you like that? We shut him up. We did it.
Rabbi Gold, when we first came on Aliyah and all my American friends were complaining, I said to them, I grew up in Canada and you were never an immigrant in America. And believe me, you were right. What you said, I suffered from that also.
Not only that, do you understand? I go into my bank in West Hempstead after I've come on coming all the way to America from Canada. You know, the bank wouldn't change my Canadian money. The teller looks at this. This is money. This is money. This is America, you understand? The seat of economic power. I want to transfer the few dollars I have in my account in Canada. I can't do it. We're going to have to speak to the head office. You're going to have to fill out about 20 forms in quadruplicate, you understand? I wasn't able to get my hands on one green American dollar bill for close to a month after my children were starving in the streets. Yeah. Okay. And I'll tell you even worse. The worst blow to my ego was the mailman didn't know who I was. In Toronto, the mailman would say hello to me, good morning, Rabbi Gold, and this Hashluga, the mailman, goes by. I mean nothing. I am nothing. And by the way, that's the way Eretz Yisrael is acquired. Eretz Yisrael is acquired through Yisurim. And there are even letters from Gedolei Yisrael that after they came to Eretz Yisrael for years, they were absolute nothings. Nobody looked at them. Nobody cared about them. They were nothing. I know what it means to be nothing. I felt like nothing. The fact is, I most probably was nothing.
You were Rabbi Gold.
I was not Rabbi Gold then. I wasn't Rabbi Gold then. Unless you thought I was always Rabbi Gold. But no, I wasn't. No. I was unemployed in this country after I gave up a great job in America. And I walked the streets of Yerushalayim because you're walking back and forth worried, how am I going to support my family? How am I going to marry your five children? Instead, I come from a great job and I end up unemployed over here. So you're going to tell me about this cardiologist or whoever he is over there. And you think everybody has great jobs in America today? My community, the community that I came from, has a special fund in order to assist people who live in this upper class community, that there should be food on the tables for Shabbos. And I'm telling you, one of these days, I'm going to have the nerve to tell somebody. A few years after I left A few years after I left West Hempstead, I come back, and one of the Balabatim says to me, and I quoted this in the past, one of the Balabatim tells me, Rabbi Gold, since you left, the community doubled in size.
Wow.
So I said, you know, since I came to her, no, it grew 100 times now. She says, no, I didn't mean that. It came out pretty bad, like, since you left, you understand? Finally, the community was able to double something. I can tell them, when I was in this community, no one was unemployed, nobody needed food stamps, and since I left this community, there are dozens of families that need food stamps.
He lives in Boca Raton, by the way, this physiotherapist. And he wants to give up Boca in Florida for Israel.
All right, you know what? If he really wants Israel, he'll be able to do it. But if he's using the bureaucracy as an excuse, he ain't never going to make it. Tell that to him in my name. Wait a minute, I'm sorry, I have another few minutes. I don't know how these things happen to me. But can you hear? Can you hear what Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is saying? Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is saying that there's an absolute existential difference between the Jewish people and the nations of the world. Even though we may be dry bones, but these are dry bones who once had life in them, divinity, and they have the potential to rebuild and start all over again. Now, we're just look. Number 33, the king says, certainly, a similar dispersion is not imaginable in any other people. Any other people who would have gone in exile and remained in exile as long as you did, it's unimaginable that they would ever have survived as a national entity. A similar dispersion is not imaginable in any other people unless it became absorbed by another, especially after so long a period. What he means is, inevitably, they're going to mix and mingle and lose their identity. Many nations which arose after you have perished without leaving a memory. Edom, Moab, Ammon, Aram, the Philistines, the Chaldeans, the Medes, the Persians, Yavam, the Brahmins, the Sabines, and many others that we don't even know their name. He's making an extremely important statement over here. How many times have I said it to you? Nations keep coming, nations keep going, passing like shadows wiped off the earth. Thou an eternal witness remainest, bearing a message, God is but one. Egypt enslaved thee, Babylon crushed thee, Rome led thee captive, homeless thy head. Where are those nations, mighty and fearsome? Thou hast survived them, they are all dead. You want the rest of the poem? I don't have to cut it. That's what he's saying over here.
What's the name of that poem?
Israel, God's greatest riddle. Israel, God's greatest riddle, by P. M. Raskin. Don't ask me what the P stands for or what the N stands for. Prime Minister. I knew you said that. But this is an extremely important statement that's been made earlier. Do you know that I had about 30 more pages prepared to learn from you today? Next week, the Lean Ada, we have to